This is the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast with Andy Benoit and your host, John Engel.
Hello and welcome to the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast for Week 9. I'm John Engel at Engel's Angle on Twitter, and Andy Benoit here with me at Andy_Benoit. You can talk to us about the show and communicate with us about what you like, don't like. But later in this show, we get a chance to speak with Khalil Mack, who's been one of the most outstanding rookies and defensive players in the league this season.
Yeah, he has no sacks, which astonished me when I heard that. I just could not believe that, because he has been one of the most dynamic and dominant edge rushers, pass rushers, also run defenders in the league so far. So it's an aberration that his numbers aren't there yet.
We'll get to Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. They're taking on the Denver Broncos at home this week, and he says he wouldn't trade any receiver on his team for a core in another group. And the Broncos and Peyton Manning could have the best wide receiver group in the league.
But Brady says he doesn't. He wouldn't trade his guys. Look, obviously he's not going to trade his guys for anybody. Guys, you know, you say that kind of thing. I don't know. The whole Brady supporting casting, I think that gets overblown a little bit, that they haven't helped him out there in New England enough. I understand it, but keep in mind, New England paid Aaron Hernandez a boatload of money before they knew that he had whatever, you know, whatever his,
right,
whatever we're going to call
it. Gronk too.
Yeah, and so they decide we're going to become a flex two tight end offense. That's where they made the investment. The Aaron Hernandez thing blew up in their face. And so they haven't gone out, and signed somebody since then. It's not that easy. You don't just go out and sign someone. DeSean Jackson would not work in that scheme. Eric Decker's just a guy. Who were they supposed to get this offseason? They got Brandon LaFell, who I think's a better fit for what they do than anybody else that they could have brought in. So I get a little tired of talking about Brady's supporting cast. Obviously, it's nothing compared to Peyton Manning's right now. And that's not to take anything away from Manning, because he makes a lot of that supporting cast as well. Demaryius Thomas was not an elite route runner until Peyton Manning came aboard. Julius Thomas, we don't know if he even knew how to play. He's a former basketball player. Emmanuel Sanders looks more equipped now to succeed than he ever did with Roethlisberger in Pittsburgh.
Well, but the fact is, Manning does have three Pro Bowlers to throw to in Wes Welker and Julius Thomas and Demaryius Thomas. Those guys are going to be Pro Bowlers elsewhere, too. It's not just Peyton Manning.
Yeah, I mean, Welker's a Pro Bowler when he was with Brady.
With Brady,
and
yeah.
Edelman's been just as productive as Welker was in that system. So I think it's all a little bit overblown about the support that Tom Brady has around him. Denver has done a better job of supporting Manning with core guys this season, but in the big scheme, in the big picture things, in the course of these guys' rivalries, and even the last 3 or 4 years, I think it's more of a wash.
So then when you look at a guy like Demaryius Thomas, who's averaging 109.6 yards or receiving yards per game, and then pair it with the Patriots' leading receiver per game, which is Julian Edelman at 58.4, I mean, that's a big discrepancy.
That's almost half. Different offenses, obviously. New England got a factor in the first few weeks where they were not on track. Different approaches, though. I mean, I guess what are you implying with that statement? I mean, what are we getting at?
Well, I mean, I think it's obvious that when it's Edelman and next best is Gronk, that unit.
Well, I think it's Gronk and next best is Edelman. You're talking about production?
Well, yardage wise.
Okay.
Yeah. But if you give Brady what Manning has, I think that's this argument, right? If you put those guys in that Patriots offense, even if that offense isn't built for those kinds of players, you're going to see a more productive offense, right?
Probably. Remember, yeah, you will. But remember, for years, the discussion about Brady and Manning was that Brady had the rings and Manning had the stats and neither could do the other thing. And then Manning won the Super Bowl in 2006, and Brady set every record imaginable at the time once he got Randy Moss in 07. We've had a lot of narratives about these guys. If you did flip it around, if you did give them, you know, put Manning on the Patriots, Brady on the Broncos, different types of systems, and the offenses would take on a whole different look. I like New England's offense overall. I like what they're doing right now. And as we've talked about with Tim Wright on other shows before, I think that's going to become more of a factor. When you keep Tim Wright on the field and you go back to that 12 personnel, you get the effect of what you were hoping to get with Hernandez. Less dynamic, but the same effect. And that is the ability to run almost any formation imaginable out of the same personnel grouping, which helps in your up-tempo stuff, which is more prominent now than ever. It helps in creating mismatches. It's hard to game plan against because You can look at the Patriots can look at the defense and say, okay, we have these, we have this 12 personnel grouping on the field, one running back, two tight ends, 12. If they play nickel against it, we run these plays on the ground. If they play base against it, we throw these plays through the air. I mean, they can do so many things. And when you have Tom Brady running that whole show, you're going to be just fine. You don't necessarily need superstars to make that work. Does it help to have superstars? Absolutely. But what's New England's record right now?
They're 6-2.
Yep.
Yeah, and this week, when you wrote your All-Pro, your midseason All-Pro, you chose Aqib Talib to be that first-team All-Pro corner, but you left out Chris Harris. That was interesting.
You sound like the Twitter trolls that were all over me.
I don't want to be a troll, but I'm just interested. I want to hear your explanation.
Chris Harris trolled it, actually, himself.
You got to retweet.
I felt like I had to apologize. Yeah, it wasn't a good one, though. I get the sentiment that Chris Harris deserved it and Talib didn't. I got caught up in the flash or something with Talib. I feel good about the pick. I didn't really think twice about it, in fact, because I think Talib's given them exactly what they wanted when they signed him for big money. He does have a little more on his plate, not a whole lot though, because they don't move those guys around as much in Denver anymore now that Roby can play the slot. I think Talib's been the playmaker, though. And there were a couple of, like, the example that comes to mind is the Chris Harris interception. I forget who they had. It was a Sunday night game, I believe. It was a big-time game, what every Bronco game, I guess.
Was
is
it
on.
The Colts game? Was it right
No,
off the
it was
bat?
Later. Well, maybe it was. But anyway, it was a cover two trap type play that Talib made perfectly, and the ball got picked off by Harris. And I just, you know, that kind of thing. I think Talib's done a lot of those subtle things very well this year. He is a little bit inconsistent, though. I do grant you that.
You also went with Troy Polamalu at safety for the Steelers. That's the next game we're going to talk about, but you might want to defend yourself a little bit.
I don't have to defend myself on that. It's like become in vogue to say that Polamalu is washed up and then say, what is this, you know, 2009 or something?
Well, but that's, haven't you been saying that during these podcasts?
No.
We've talked about how he's not himself.
I know. No, we haven't.
Yeah, we did. Past
no.
podcasts.
No, I have never.
I'm look up the archive.
Look, has Troy Polamalu lost a hint of his speed? Yeah, probably. Is he still the most dynamic safety in the NFL? Yes, he is. And look, the way I choose these teams, I write out every possible name that could be on there, 10 or 11 guys, and I just go through my notes and read each thing on each guy and see who's being used in what ways and who's most dynamic. Polamalu shows up in the notes 3 times more than the next most safety. Some of it bad, grant you. Most of it very good. And he does a lot of stuff that doesn't get shown. But you can't reflect in any statistic, in no matter what metric you have, you can't gather passes that aren't thrown because of what guys do in coverage. And Polamalu's excellent in that sense.
I was a little surprised you didn't go with Weddle, our buddy, our podcast.
Yeah,
he
was the 5th safety on my list, so he barely missed the second team. I mean, look, John, it's just, you know, it's hard to do. I mean, these, you know, I'm not the authority on this. I'm just going off of how it's looked on film this year. And if you told me, hey, Eric Weddle is going to be first team all pro, I wouldn't blink or complain about that.
And speaking of Polamalu, our next matchup is a divisional matchup, which are even more fun for us to talk about. The Baltimore Ravens are on the road against the Pittsburgh Steelers. And Big Ben coming off that monstrous game. Unbelievable. That's exactly the point. Yeah, and both teams are 5-3. And the Ravens beat the Steelers 26-6 back in week 2. So heading into this game, what's going to be different about these teams than we saw earlier in the season?
They're both better than they were in week 2. And let's start with, you mentioned Roethlisberger's game. Let's start with that real quick. I watched the film on that. It was easy film to watch because it was perfect quarterbacking in the first half. And very, very rarely did I have to hit rewind to go see something because when the plays work exactly as designed, there's not a whole lot to break down. Indianapolis had good coverage throughout that game. Not great coverage, but good coverage, good enough. They were in man-to-man most of the game. And Roethlisberger, we could have touched on this with Manning, Roethlisberger had an unbelievable sense of anticipation for his guys against man coverage. And that's what makes Manning so great now. He's an anticipation passer. And we think of that as something against zone defense because you anticipate windows. But the really great ones can anticipate against man-to-man coverage as well. And Roethlisberger did that perfectly, masterfully, in that game against Indianapolis last week.
I think I asked you about this a couple podcasts ago when the Steelers were putting up really pretty good offensive numbers yardage-wise, but the points weren't coming. It was a big offense, over 400 yards of total offense, but you weren't seeing the touchdowns result. And is this the culmination of what we've been expecting from an offense with a lot of pieces?
Maybe a little bit. I think what's different from when we talked about that, they were getting a lot of big yards off of stuff that was not very sustainable. Not trick plays, but gimmicky type of play, you know, plays with wrinkles and stuff.
Well, and I'm not implying that the Steelers are going to put up 639 yards of total offense every week, but it does seem like that breaking point of them getting over that.
Yeah, I think they have. Yep, I think a big difference has been the insertion of Martavis Bryant into the lineup because he gives them a speed factor over the top. We talked about this last week, I believe, and they used that very well against Indianapolis, and that opens up other route combinations when you have that kind of a threat. And specifically, it helps Antonio Brown a lot. So it's a more dangerous Steeler offense, but then their pass protection's been better. Mike Munchak's done a very good job with that offensive line. It's every year it seems like we've talked about some form of instability with Pittsburgh's O-line, and we really have not had that issue this season. And we've seen them succeed in the ground game, zone blocking, some man blocking with DeCastro on pulls. And they were sensational in pass protection last week against both straight four-man rushes and the blitz. So it's a very good offense now when things are clicking. And a lot of it comes down to Roethlisberger playing within the timing and rhythm of the offense. That's never been his game. It's become his game a little bit more than the last few years. And last week it was just outstanding. And if he can, he's not going to do that every week, but if you can get that kind of play from him, you're still going to sprinkle in the Big Ben plays as well, and he had a few of those, then this is a dangerous team.
Big Ben play, are you talking about him hopping out of a tackle?
Yep.
Doing
yep.
The bunny hop on the way out?
Yep, that was, you saw the play then, you know what I'm, yeah.
Is that what you were going to get at then?
Well, he does some form of sack illusion every week, it seems like. I still think Baltimore's the best team in this division, though.
But I think what we're seeing is that Baltimore has been that more consistent team in the North through the beginning of the season, and the Steelers have had inconsistency on offense. But I think the Ravens last week, what we saw in that game against the Bengals is there isn't a whole lot of separation between these teams. There's a lot of good teams this year, not a lot of great teams.
I agree with that. It seems like I think Baltimore matches up well to Pittsburgh. I think Cincinnati matches up well to Baltimore, and I think Pittsburgh matches up well to Cincinnati. It's
a little love triangle.
It is, yeah. And then Cleveland sprinkled somewhere in there with the occasional upset.
Yeah, just busting everyone's dreams.
The Ravens are going to be a very good team in the second half of the year. I don't know if it's going to be reflected in their record or not. I think it will be. But their defense, if everyone stays healthy, and I say that with caution now because Jimmy Smith is on the shelf for a little bit with a foot injury, and that's the one position that they can't afford too many injuries at. Ladarius Webb's been iffy at times in terms of health this year, and he wasn't practicing this week at times. Dominic Franks is now the number two corner, and then that's it. They don't play another corner. They have only safeties that they use. So it's not a great secondary, but that front seven is tremendous. And so if they can stay above water with Jimmy Smith gone, they're going to get him back by the end of the year, and they're going to be a top five defense easily.
And CJ Mosley, the rookie, squeaked his way into your midseason All-Pro, didn't he?
I had him second.
Was it second or
team.
Third?
I didn't do a third team, so it would have been second team.
Yeah, that's impressive for him. He's having a great year.
He is having a very good year. And Darryl Smith had his best game of the season last week. What's really made this defense special, and I know Cincinnati beat them, so let's, you know, some credit to the Bengals there. I've watched the film, and they're not coming off their best game. But Cincinnati beat them on the other side of the ball, not this defense. What's made this defense really impressive and pushed them into, I think, elite status is the play of Brandon Williams at nose tackle. Because now you're getting a dominant force at times. He's not every down dominant, but he's flashing. You're getting that alongside Haloti Ngata. And that is a powerful 1-2 punch. And you get a dynamic defensive tackle duo that combines to weigh about 700 pounds. That's special. We haven't seen very many of those in the history of football, and you can do a lot of other things because of that.
Well, and especially since Brandon Williams is a young guy. It's only his second year in the league, and Haloti Ngata is getting up in age. So maybe a little – they're different positions, but
yep.
Kind of transition here maybe?
Perhaps. I think – you know, Nada's only 30 years old. I mean, I think he seems older because he's had some of the injuries, and He looks wise, you know, a little bit. He makes old man type plays. He gets deflected passes.
And an effective defensive lineman 9 years in the league, you start to think he's going to wear down, but it just hasn't happened.
Well, it happened a few years ago. He showed signs, but he had a quad injury apparently that nobody knew about till after the season. But it hasn't happened the last year and a half. They drafted Timmy Jernigan as well to eventually replace probably Haloti not on team with Brandon Williams. And Jernigan has looked good. He hasn't played a whole lot, so it's hard to tell. But he looked, you know, he's a guy where I watched the film and I go, who's 97? And I look up his name a few times because he kept popping out. It's a good defense. Now, John, for this game, I know we got to get on to Arizona-Dallas here, but I think what I'm really excited to see is the other side of the ball and Pittsburgh's defense. They came alive with blitzes against Indianapolis, and it helped that they were up by 20-something points most of the game, so they knew every down was third down, essentially. But they finally got their pass rush going, and some of their blitz concepts that hadn't been working early in the year came to life. It helped also that the Colts' offensive line is not athletic. I'm curious to see how Baltimore responds to it because they had a lot of trouble against Cincinnati with double A gap blitz concepts last week, and Pittsburgh did a lot of that against Indianapolis.
Well, and conceptually, that defense is, or those combinations of blitzes, what has made the Steelers so good in the past and that we have been kind of looking for this season.
And they blazed the Phil Simms said it best. And in fact, it was, I think, in when these teams bet,
I think
in week
we have
two,
one Phil Simms reference a podcast.
I like Phil Simms.
It's apparent that he knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, a lot of people don't like Phil Simms. I do not understand that. I think he's an excellent announcer. But
so what do you say?
You can differ on the opinion if you want. He made the great point that Pittsburgh blazed the trail with a lot of these double-A gap stuff. And Jim Johnson in Philadelphia did a lot of it as well. But with the 3-4 double-A gap blitz concepts, the Fire X blitzes, Pittsburgh was right there back in the 90s, early 2000s, and the league caught on and copied it. And Pittsburgh got caught in the wash, and now they're very average. They've been very average at it, and other teams have taken over. So we're seeing a little bit of a reclaiming of the crown with that one.
Well, and this game is certainly a battle of two of the best teams in the AFC North, but we also have a game that could be between two of the best teams in the NFC or maybe even the league in the Arizona Cardinals on the road with the Cowboys.
Yeah, and speaking of double-A gap blitz stuff.
Yeah, that's Arizona.
Yeah, Arizona, and they're right now the standard setter for that, and both post-snap and pre-snap. There's two forms of double-A gap. They're not two forms, but there's two elements. One is when you align the linebackers up in the A-gaps before the snap. When you do that, you dictate protections because the offense goes, oh, crap, our center can't block two guys at once. So they have to respond somehow to it, and the way they respond creates other matchups and one-on-one matchups for other people along the line. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, isn't that what they used to love to do with Carlos Dansby before he went to Cleveland?
Yeah, they did that. They did that. And Ray Horton, their previous coordinator with Todd Bowles, did as well. And Cleveland signed Dansby in part because he's so good at these kinds of concepts. Dansby's good in the post-snap phase, which is the other element of the double-A gap stuff, which is where you don't show it, but you bring it. So guys come out of regular linebacker positions and rush. And that's what Pittsburgh did for a long time. And they when they were at their best with it, you could argue they drafted Lawrence Timmons. I think they planned to play him outside, and they wound up moving him inside to play this role as the blitzer. But you could argue the years right before Timmons came on, when it was James Ferrier and Larry Foote, who I hope we have on the podcast at some point this year.
Who's in this game we're talking about right now.
Yeah, and I talked to him about this double-A-gap stuff, and he's excellent. He can explain it. But Larry Foote is outstanding at taking on blocks as a blitzer. And when you have a guy like that, you can crash into the guards, crash into the centers, take the running back, whatever you do, but you create the lanes for other guys to come through. And Arizona does that very well. They've done it with Deion Buchanan, their rookie safety, who's going to be a star. They bring Rashad Johnson, their other safety at times. It's the best blitzing team in the NFL conceptually, and a lot of it starts with Foote. And now they're going against a Cowboys team that could not identify the blitz to save its life on Monday night.
With the injuries and with the departure of Dansby, did you think that kind of system would still work? Does it work with any personnel there on defense?
I think it does if you have the right guys to play man coverage behind it.
Which they certainly do.
They do. And Patrick Peterson's had a very up-and-down year by his standards especially. But they can still ask him to play one-on-one on an island, and it's a competitive matchup. So just – then that's kind of like when I make the all-pro teams, that's the kind of things I look for, not just who's playing well, but who's being asked to carry the heaviest loads, because there are hidden benefits to that for an entire team. And Peterson gives the Cardinals that kind of a benefit. It's a good schematic defense in Arizona. They were unpredictable with their blitzes against Philadelphia last week. So, based on Romo's troubles against identifying the blitz and some of his offensive line, but mostly him, I would think we're going to see some other forms of unpredictability this week. I don't know in what ways, but Todd Bowles will have something.
Well, and it's been well documented, these zero blitzes that the Redskins went with. Do you see that happening again with the Cardinals?
Yeah, because of those man-to-man guys. And Bowles will do the cover zero blitzes. And cover zero blitz just means you have no extra help defender in safety. It doesn't mean you have nobody in coverage, obviously.
Right, but the Redskins also did that without a ton of support help they need that support help in the secondary.
Yeah, the Washington got away with some stuff.
Yeah.
And their cornerbacks overachieved and played very well. But the Cowboys, the reason why teams do a cover zero blitz is because no matter what, they're going to have one more guy than you can block. It's just mathematics. If there's one-on-one on every receiver there, then the defense has one guy who's supposedly responsible for the quarterback if we're to match 11-on-11. Well, the quarterback's not running a route, and Tony Romo's not going to run around. So that guy who's responsible for the quarterback really just becomes the extra blitzer, and that's who can't be blocked. And it's on the quarterback to recognize that, and Romo did not recognize that. And to Washington's credit, they brought the blitzers from different spots every time. Arizona will do something similar in some fashion.
Don't the Cowboys have the perfect wide receiver to abuse a cover zero concept in Dez Bryant?
If he
comes across the middle, there's not a whole lot you can do.
Yeah, Dez Bryant's a guy most teams do not play one-on-one. Some teams have this year, though, and they've gotten away with it at times, and they've gotten burned with it at times. And, John, it's a good question, because probably how that goes, if Bryant can make a play against cover zero, that'll probably determine how this game goes.
We usually look to the next week, but I do want to get your opinion on kind of how the Cowboys were going at the Redskins there in that overtime period. It didn't seem like DeMarco Murray was even a factor.
Yeah, they didn't. He ran the ball on 1st and 10 and got 8 yards, I think it was. It was a very good run, and I thought, here we go. Here comes the march downfield. And it slipped away very fast. They threw the ball on the next down, and it did not – I think it was incomplete, something like that. But they got caught in that 3rd down and odd types of yardage and distance, and they got away from the run game in the process. It was – we could talk – I'm always hesitant to question play calling after the fact, but it was a little bizarre that DeMarco Murray didn't get more touches.
Yeah, and the Cowboys have been very – reliant on that run game, a team that hasn't been so reliant on the run this year, the San Diego Chargers on the road with the Miami Dolphins, and they haven't won since the 1981 season there in Miami.
Was that the Winslow game?
That was the Kellen Winslow game.
I wasn't alive, but everybody has seen the pictures of that.
Yeah, but what the Chargers have been able to do this season without that run game has been pretty spectacular, but they're going up against a great front seven in Miami.
Yeah, what are their run? Do you have their run numbers?
Yeah, this year they're 28th in the league in rushing, and last year over those last 5 games when the running game really started to pick up, 91 yards in the fifth to last game, then 144, 177, 148, and 186.
Yeah, and I have a feeling that ranked near the top of the league.
Yeah.
And what was interesting with that last year is that it was a commitment to the run. They did not, if I recall, they did not have very many long runs. They didn't suddenly get it right. They ran the ball at a high volume again and again, and they converted a lot of 3rd down and shorts. Now they're not playing that brand of football, and I don't think that's the way you play Miami anyway. Although Miami, that defensive line, as good as it is, and if you listen to this podcast, you'd know that I think it's a top 5 run defending front four. It does tend to wear down just a little bit. It has over the years, even late in the season, but also late in games. So maybe San Diego takes that approach. I kind of doubt it, though. I think it's going to be Phillip Rivers chucking the ball.
Well, and according to ESPN, the Dolphins are blitzing on 35.5% of dropbacks, which is 9th in the league.
But that'll go down. That'll go down this week.
Right, because Phillip Rivers has been one of the best against the blitz this year.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I'm sure his numbers are very good against the blitz, and he's smart. It's hard to blitz smart quarterbacks, and he's also willing to stand in there and take some hits. He doesn't get hit a lot, but he has the willingness. He has excellent pocket movement. We could have a whole other discussion on Phillip Rivers if we wanted, because I think he gets as much out of his feet as any quarterback in the NFL. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but his pocket movement and his eyes downfield, his movement, he's extraordinary with it.
Well, and we've talked about his mobility a lot on this podcast too. We've praised Phillip Rivers' feet more than I think anyone has. And this game may not have a ton of flash, but now the Chargers seem to be in that realm where they're just competing for a wild card there in the AFC. But speaking about blitzing and aggressiveness off the edge and the front, Khalil Mack for the Oakland Raiders has been outstanding in his rookie season this year. And they're on the road with the Seattle Seahawks, and you got a chance to catch up with him.
I did. I talked to him earlier in the week, and we caught him just after we got out of the weight
room. He's a little tired.
Yeah, the Raiders PR staff did a great job of getting to him for us. His schedule was tight, I guess. So we got him a winded Khalil Mack, but I chatted him up, and we'll just share that right now.
Talking with Raiders first-round rookie Khalil Mack. And Khalil, I've watched every Raiders snap this season, and I hate to start out negative. I was astonished, though, that when I was told that you have no sacks, and I'm not a stats guy, I'm a film guy. To me, you've played at an all-pro level. I've got you 13 all-pro right now. Do you feel like you have played at that level? How do you feel your season is going?
I'm trying to get better every week, man. But even then, I'm trying to go out, help the team just win, man.
How has the adjustment to the NFL been so far relative to what you expected?
It's everything you dream of, man. But even then, it's all football. So you can just focus in on what you need to do throughout the week and get your body right. You know, loving it, but at the same time, you want to go out and get some wins.
A lot of people make a big deal about the transition from a smaller college program to the pros. Have you felt any of that effect?
No. I haven't felt that, only because my expectation was so high. Now that I'm playing now, it's getting better and better every week, and it's getting a little easier for me every week.
What has been the most challenging part of your adjustment? What's been the biggest surprise about the NFL so far to you?
The biggest surprise so far has been the fans and the stage and how big it is on Sundays, man. It's different, you know. It's different than being at a UB game versus Miami, Ohio, you know what I mean? Yeah, it's a lot different, you know. So, yeah, it's been a blessing, man.
How about on the field with the scheme or competition or the types of stuff you see from opponents each week or in your preparation? What's been the biggest surprise that far about in that regard about your pro career so far?
The surprise so far has been the quarterback, and they don't hold the ball to get it out. Playing against guys like Tom Brady and I can keep going on and on. These guys don't hold the ball for you to be able to touch them. So that's a big change that I've seen.
You're not just a defensive end. You play that often in the sub packages, but in a lot of the base packages, you're an outside linebacker. Has that transition, is one position more challenging than the other to transition to?
No. That's what I've always done. I've always played linebacker and defensive end. And it's the only thing I can say is different is the quarterbacks, man. They get the ball a lot fast.
Mm-hmm.
Make it hard to get there on time. And so, yeah, I'm just working on getting better at that every week.
Your defensive coordinator, talk about your D coordinator, Jason Tarver. Raider fans have a lot of polarizing opinions on him. I've gotten to know him a little bit, and I think he is, just in conversation, he seems like the smartest coach in the league. I mean, he can go a million miles an hour on a million different topics and give you different perspectives on all of them that you've never thought of. Have you encountered that? What's it like being in the meeting rooms with him?
I mean, like you said, man, he's one of the smartest people in the National Football League. He gives you insight on the game, and he prepares you to be ready for everything they're gonna try to throw at you that week competition. So yeah, he's a bright guy, man, and he gets you ready, man, and he puts you in positions to make plays, and you gotta take advantage of it.
Let me get you out of here on this question. You have outstanding short area explosiveness, lateral movement in confined spaces. Obviously, some of that's God-given athleticism, but can some of that also be learned? Is that something you can practice and enhance?
I mean, every week, especially on Wednesdays and Thursdays and Fridays, you go out there and you practice at full speed. And I feel like practicing at full speed is practicing those short movements and those intricacies where you can get in spaces and try to make plays and then use your athleticism to your advantage. So I go out every week, man, and I practice full speed and try to put myself in position to make plays. And so I feel like practice is key in this league, and taking advantage of it has been beneficial to me.
Our thanks once again to Khalil Mack, who's having a great season, and of course the Oakland Raiders PR staff. Andy, how do you see him doing against this Seattle Seahawks front line?
Yeah, he might. I don't know if this will be the week for the sack either, because Russell Wilson, not everybody rushes him. Carolina did, and it didn't really work out great for them. They did okay, I guess. But there's a lot of you might mush rush against Wilson in an effort to keep him in the pocket. So I don't know if they'll let Khalil Mack turn it loose or not this week. I would hope they do. I
more of kind of a contain function.
Yeah, and maybe there might be other ways they can contain Wilson. I hope they turn it loose, but I would understand if they don't.
Well, and containing Russell Wilson is difficult, but there's a lot of running backs in this league who have that similar bounce to the outside ability, and that's what we have in LeSean McCoy coming up against Arian Foster in this game between the Eagles and the Texans, which kind of puts you at the spot where you go, well, who would you rather want right now, LeSean McCoy or Arian Foster? Arian Foster is clearly having the better year.
He is, and all right, so we're asking who we would take. If it's for 1 year, not just like this season, but, you know, we have 1 year ahead, let's say it's next year, I think I'd take Foster. I always get smirked at when I say this, but it depends on the system I'm running. But I know that's we're not having that specific of a discussion. Foster's, you know, he's actually become underrated because he disappeared with the back injury for a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's second in the league in rushing, I believe.
Yes.
And he has a great he glides as a runner, yet he has power. He's a very unique back. He's Eddie George with some agility.
Well, and I mentioned that to you. Was it against the Texans were playing where he had a run of, I think it was 35, 40 yards, but I mentioned that it looked like he was moving in slow motion, and you're like, well, what does that mean? But I think it was that gliding kind of style that he has.
He makes running look easy. And McCoy's a more dynamic runner, pure runner. But as a running back, as a football player, I think Arian Foster gives you more. He could also compete in the passing game. He has good hands.
Well, and they both have that ability. They both have the ability to be a function of the passing game. But LeSean McCoy doesn't seem to be successful unless he bounces outside and makes a guy miss, whereas Arian Foster routinely can go inside.
I agree. That's a great way to say it. Foster can do what I think is one of the most important things a running back can do, and that is get you 4 yards when you need 4 yards.
A lot of what DeMarco Murray has been for the Cowboys.
Murray right now is getting you 8 when you need 4. No, he's similar. Obviously, he's more similar to Murray than he is. They're kind of similar runners in a lot of ways.
Alike, yeah.
Murray's not nearly as smooth as Foster, but you can't go wrong with either. And because Murray's having such an all-time type season so far, Foster's getting badly overlooked.
Does it seem like LeSean McCoy may be more dependent on that offensive line being successful then, and Arian Foster isn't so tied to it?
Not necessarily, because McCoy has that bounce outside ability, and Foster is really good with his vision. And Houston's offensive line is extremely, even though Kubiak's gone now, and it's a different approach with with Bill O'Brien, they still have done a lot of zone running, and they've been extremely effective with it. They're very well schooled as a zone blocking unit, and Foster, his strength is as a zone runner.
When we're seeing that the Texans are successful when they ride the running game, and that's much like we've seen out of the San Francisco 49ers this season too with Frank Gore, and the Niners are coming off a bye, and the St. Louis Rams are the team that can catch you when you're down. I don't know. You can't sleep on them.
The Rams, you know, the Steelers play up and down to their competition a lot, and the Rams play up to and down to their competition a lot too, but the Rams can play up to their competition. I mean, they're not a team.
Seattle.
They're not a team you just chalk up a victory against. I'm curious about the Mark Barron trade. I know that that happened this week, so maybe we don't see exactly how they plan on using him in this game. But I think they're going to become a dime defense now. I don't know if they take Alec Ogletree off the field because he's a good athlete. Laurinaitis has – I think he's been up and down in coverage this year, but he's not the guy you take off the field either because he's the only guy out there with any kind of experience in the back end. I just wonder where Barron will play. McLeod is the other safety they have, and T.J. McDonald's the other safety, and one of those guys will come off the field if Barron comes on the field and they don't go dime. And those guys have also been up and down, but I think they have something to offer. I don't think you give up on McLeod or McDonald yet. So I'm just wondering where Barron fits in there. They'll figure out something. Greg Williams will figure out something.
Well, and that defense is pretty interesting too, because Robert Quinn obviously isn't racking up those sack numbers that we've seen from him in the past, but rookie tackle Aaron Donald, he looks pretty impressive so far.
He does, and some people thought I should have put him on the All-Pro team. If we're talking weeks 5 through 8, then yes.
Yeah, but most recently.
Yeah, but Donald didn't get the snaps early in the year, so you can't put him on there. But he is showing why he was the first-round pick, and he's quickly becoming their best interior player.
Even a bit undersized, too. That speed is showing.
He plays low to the ground. He has good, violent hands. He can move in a phone booth. He gets 4 or 5 penetration plays a game. And as soon as he becomes more consistent, he'll be on a lot of All-Pro
teams. And I think I was reading something the other day that was kind of diagramming the different kinds of things he does with his hands. You talk about those powerful, aggressive hand movements he does, kind of Watt-like is what the comparison was.
Yeah, and Watt has longer. Donald, I think, has kind of long arms as well. I need to get a visual in my mind of him. J.J. Watt's a different type of beast.
Of course.
And
physically.
And the body just structure is he's longer, and he's longer and just as quick. But Donald has a chance to be a really special three technique, and he can also play the nose shade at times.
The 49ers are without their starting center, Daniel Kilgore, for the season with that broken left ankle. And even when they had Kilgore, Aaron Donald was not struggling at all getting through.
Yeah, and that was when the Rams weren't getting sacks either. And Joe Staley in that game, I remember, did a great job on Robert Quinn. Quinn came to life the last few weeks, and the Rams look like their front four is back to being the Rams, and Donald has been a part of that. So it'll be a tough matchup here for the Niners in that regard. The Rams have played them pretty well over the years in close games in recent years.
Well, and Donald's been compared slightly to at least Geno Atkins there, the tackle for the Cincinnati Bengals. They're hosting Jacksonville this week, and Jaguars quarterback Blake Bortles is coming off the game of 2 pick-6 performance, and the loss to the Dolphins, he looked awful.
Yeah, he did.
It was miserable.
It was one of those rookie learning experiences. You have those sometimes, and hopefully the key is you got to take the learning with it, though. You have to learn from it. And on the interceptions, one of them was a bad read. He just didn't read a defender coming back against a crossing pattern. He was on a rollout to his left when he did it.
He threw off it looked weird when he threw off. He didn't even know which foot he wanted to throw.
We're talking about the Delmas interception,
the first one.
And he's had a bad – remember the Weddle interception was in a similar part of the field. Different play, and he was a drop back on that one in different coverage. But it's the same kind of mistake we saw. And then the other interception, I believe that was Brent Grimes that had that. Just a bad, inaccurate throw and a very good cornerback play. Let's assume he'll move on from that. I mean, he's not going to throw interceptions every single week, but the Bengals are not the defense to take your learning experiences and get on track against either.
Especially against the Ravens, they held Joe Flacco to 195 yards, and the only team to be able to hold him to less were the Steelers in week 2, and the Ravens have been able to move the ball at will.
Yeah, the Bengals dominated the Ravens with their on defense, the Bengals defense. They did a ton with their double A gap stuff, which I expect that they do every week, and I'll expect that they continue that against Jacksonville's interior offensive line, which has been playing better, by the way. It was awful at the front of the year. It's not been awful lately. The Bengals do a lot with coverage rotations as well, and that's where it could be concerning for Bortles and what we've talked about with him not reading the Weddle coverage rotation, with him not seeing Delmas come off his guy. The Bengals are going to throw something at him in that regard, and that could be problematic because also the Bengals just shut out a Ravens team that has good wide receivers, and Torrey Smith's okay, but Steve Smith, an excellent receiver, those guys were pretty much wiped out of the game. Jacksonville's had that exact problem this year. Their receivers tend to get wiped out of games.
Well, and with Blake Bortles and like all of these young quarterbacks, we always talk about just making it confusing there with the defense, and that's what the Bengals are obviously going to aim to do.
And I think what we'll see them do is get him playing fast by creating the illusion of pressure. So when they go to those double-A gaps, I would expect that they'll drop those linebackers back. Now, here's the one concern that I just dawned on me. Vontaze Burfict is out of this game.
And 3 weeks.
He's a big part of what they do at the double-A gap because of his range and athleticism. So if you do not have him in the lineup, my guess is they'll have Lemur. And Ray Malauga was out last week. I don't know if he's playing this week, but it'll be Lemur and at times Vincent Ray in there. That's still enough speed to do double A-gap stuff, but you're talking about an overall downtick in your linebacking effectiveness. And so they might be – when they had this same issue against the Colts when they had their face plant game a few weeks ago, and they did not do as much stuff with their blitzes. We might see that again. I would expect, though, Paul Gunther's going to – I think – he rolls the dice by blitzing with his young guys, but the benefit is that he's blitzing an even younger guy in the Jaguars quarterback.
After the hot start for the Bengals, didn't it seem that it was the defense that just needed to catch up to kind of right the ship with this team?
I never got the sense the defense was behind, but we also haven't seen the defense. The defense is coming off, in my opinion, its best game of the season. I mean, I guess maybe I don't know if they've had better statistical games, but – you know, the defense was – I thought the defense was fine early in the year, though. It was nice to see them bounce back against – from the Colts game, but the offense was also bad against the Colts. It was – this is how do you figure the NFL? The Bengals get destroyed by the Colts when they absolutely throttled. And then the next
and
week –
and then beat a probably more well-rounded team in the Ravens.
Yep. A team that knows them, too, is familiar with them. They're familiar with Baltimore. It's
familiar this season. Not only just familiar, I mean, in the landscape of the AFC North,
yeah, they
but
played
this
in
year.
Week one. Yeah, they played – it's NFL. You know, I'm glad I'm not a gambler on this league.
Sticking in the AFC North, the Cleveland Browns hosting Tampa Bay this week. Are you a little surprised that Doug Martin wasn't traded?
I think they tried to move him, and it didn't work out. Doug Martin's – it seems like he might be going in that Michael Clayton direction for the Bucs. Remember, Michael Clayton had dominant rookie year, a very good one, and that was all she wrote until George Clooney came along, I guess, a few years later and made everybody really forget that there was ever Michael Clayton, a football player.
Yeah. No, well, and what doesn't make sense is that Martin's rookie year, that 2012 year with 319 carries, 1,400 yards, for it to fall off so much, I mean, you skip the injury year, and then you come back thinking you'll at least get half that. That's
not
even close.
What's he at now? Do you know?
He's at 58 carries for 166 yards and one touchdown.
So we can't even say what he's on. We can't even do the whole he's on pace for because the sample size isn't big enough. He hasn't been available to them. Yeah, Doug Martin is when he's right, when he's healthy, he's got all the tools you want in a running back. He could work. I could see him. I think we heard that New England was maybe interested in him. Who knows if that's true or not? But
that would have been interesting.
Yeah, because I could see him replacing Stephen Ridley. Like he's almost that kind of a runner, Stephen Ridley type runner, only a little more slippery, a little harder.
Shane
Vereen's
used more in the pass anyway.
Yeah, but obviously he's not going to be a Patriot, and now he's in Tampa Bay, and he's going up against the worst run defense in the league, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not a stats guy, but I heard that somewhere. I think Cleveland, they haven't looked very good on film.
Yeah, they're 30th in the league in rushing yards allowed per game at 143.4 a game.
Okay, who's 133.4?
143.
Who's 31st?
They're narrowly beating out St. Louis, who's at 144.7. And then, you know who's worst? I think you can guess this. We've talked.
It's hard to just pull one out of the. We have?
Yes.
On other shows?
Yes. About their inability to stop the run. I'll give you a couple seconds. Interior problems.
That makes
Green Bay Packers.
Oh, of course. Yes. Thank you. Yeah.
You knew that.
Yeah. Thank you. Who's number one? Just real quick, is it still Arizona?
Who's best?
Yeah.
Best in total yardage and yards per game is Denver Broncos.
Really?
Yes.
That's partly because they've had a big lead, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Can you do who's attempted what against them?
Who's attempted
number
what?
Of attempts against Denver?
Number of attempts against Denver.
Where do they rank there? And then we'll move on.
149, lowest.
Lowest, yeah, there you go. Yeah. See, that's why.
That's the reason. Everyone's in third down already.
Yeah.
Basically. All right, and this week the quarterback drama continues for the New York Jets as they visit Kansas City, who's having kind of a good season this year. But now Michael Vick is the starter. Rex Ryan's announced it, and it seems like thoughts of Geno Smith being the guy in New York are gone.
The thoughts were almost gone when they brought in Michael Vick.
Yeah, halftime.
The writing, well, even back in the offseason, I mean, they were talking. Vick signed in February, I believe. I remember because I was at the combine sitting in.
Yeah, and it was should Vick be the starter right off the bat.
Yeah, you don't bring in Michael Vick to just be your backup. You just don't. It was a hedging move that they did, and we're seeing why they did it. Now, I haven't seen the Bills film yet. I'll take a look at it. But Geno Smith, I guess, had three interceptions in the first quarter.
Yeah, it was on his first seven attempts.
Okay, so I understand why they would pull him. I mean, you almost pull him for his own sake there. Look, Geno Smith's had opportunities. I think he's looked good at times. I thought he looked better last year than he has this year. I like the skill set that he has, but it doesn't – the consistency's nowhere close to there. Now, that could also be a description of Michael Vick's entire career.
Right, and the Chiefs have someone who's been the model of consistency this season, the anti-mess, Alex Smith.
Yeah, Alex Smith you bring in when you just want your quarterback – well, maybe not. I was going to say you want your quarterback issues to go away, but Alex Smith was in a controversy, I guess, a few years ago by no fault of his own, though. That was the good kind of controversy. One out of 50 controversies are the good kind of
benefit
quarterbacks.
Benefit team.
Yeah, what's like who's – do we go with this guy who's over 100 rating, or do we go with this guy who has more skill, more talent? But that's not what the Jets have. The Jets do not have that issue. They have two quarterbacks who, frankly, can't play, and the system's not working great with them right now.
So say you put Alex Smith in New York.
I don't mean to say they can't play, but they're not playing effectively right now. I'm sorry.
Okay, I want to put you through the scenario, though, now that it's been teased. How much better would the Jets be with an Alex Smith?
In New York?
In New York.
That is a good question because that speaks to Alex Smith's the ultimate plug-in placeholder type QB. Can you and I agree on that? I know other people don't agree, but would you agree?
I don't know though with the Jets.
Well, I know, but I'm saying if we talk about him
in general,
yeah, as a concept. And so if he is that, then we plug him in, and how would that work out for all parties?
He'll have special moments, but he won't be special all the time.
I don't know if he even have that many special moments.
I mean,
I think Alex Smith would get exposed with the Jets.
I kind of do too, because it's a lot more down the field stuff than Andy Reid expects from him. Of his 9 touchdowns this season, he doesn't have a touchdown that's traveled more than 5 yards.
Alex Smith doesn't?
Yes.
Really?
Isn't that interesting?
That is. Now, they're very good in the red zone, and he's very good in the red zone. They do a lot with misdirection concepts, but that is. Yeah, I mean, that kind of is that's an extreme testament to Alex Smith's game. And look, that works for him. It's not what we're talking about with Alex Smith.
It's not a detractor, no.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing necessarily. It's not a great thing because we are talking about other guys we'd rather have than him. But
there's a few.
Alex Smith's laughing all the way to the bank and well-deserved, and he's laughed to the postseason last year. It had great numbers down the stretch. It works. He's a system QB, but he works within the system well. And he does what you need from that. The Jets would love to have an Alex Smith right now because he at least isn't going to throw the ball to the other team 3 times in 7 attempts. I don't think Alex Smith would thrive, though. And the reason why is the same reason that those other guys in New York haven't thrived. The Jets' supporting cast really isn't very good. Even with Percy Harvin, they're not just going to plug him in and be good to go there. That's going to take a few weeks.
Our last Sunday game we'll get to, Washington is visiting Minnesota. Both of them coming off overtime wins.
How about
something
the play,
to be happy about.
Yeah, how about the play Anthony Barr made? Anthony Barr is having an excellent rookie season. I don't watch college, so I didn't know much about him coming in, but I heard, from what I heard, He was the guy who was supposed to take a little bit of time to transition to the NFL.
Because of size issues and this
and yeah, I think he's a tweener, kind of maybe learn a new position. I don't want to speak out of turn. I don't know, but I'd heard that somewhere. He hasn't taken a whole lot of transition time. He plays in their nickel package, which is not easy to do under Zimmer for the same reasons that we talked about with the Bengals and what they ask of those linebackers to do. He's very good on the rundowns out of the base package. And he takes good pass to the ball, and he for his size, he moves very well to the ball.
Conceptually, the defenses of Baltimore and Minnesota are differently, but how does Barr stack up so far from what you've seen from C.J. Mosley, who could likely be the defensive rookie of the year?
Different types of players because, well, they both play in the nickel, so they're similar in that sense because nickel linebackers kind of tend to do the same types of things. They play out of the stacked position. They're not playing on the edge so much. But different types of players. Mosley's more of a run and chase guy.
Barr's a lot bigger. Got about 20 pounds and 3 inches.
Yeah, I was going to say Barr is. That seems about right. So if I had to pick who I'd rather have, which you didn't ask, but now I'm curious to think about who I'd rather have. Oh, man. I think I'd take Mosley.
I think you're kind of splitting hairs, though.
Of course I am at this point. But I think I'd take Mosley because there just seems to be a longevity factor with him. I could see him being effective for a long time because you can see his football IQ really improve each week, although you can with Anthony Barr, too. These are both two excellent players.
I haven't watched Barr a whole lot, but with Mosley, it seems like there's so much anticipation there, and he's great in coverage.
He has better guys around him than Barr does. But not by far, but he has a veteran next to him in Darryl Smith. Barr plays with Chad Greenway. I don't know, John. You got me talking out of both sides of my mouth here wondering. I give me either guy and I'll be happy.
And with Washington, we may be seeing RG3 come back as much as we kind of want to end this
the
saga.
The obligatory RG3 conversation.
We had to at least mention it.
While we're in the media, we have to. And especially a Sports Illustrated related thing. RG3's
Ooh.
That's
a crack at the company, man.
No, that's not a crack.
You watch it.
Company.
That was Andy Benoit.
We did RG3 stuff when the MMQB launched last summer. We did RG3 stuff. It felt like every day the first week. I mean, he was the guy last year though too. Remember that? And he's still kind of the guy. And I don't get that jazzed up talking about RG3 because to me it's like we're talking about the return of maybe the 15th. Best quarterback in the league best.
And when he leaves, you don't get a chance to forget about him for a little while. He's still always there. It's not like, hey, Andy, remember RG3?
Right,
What's he been up to over the last year while he's rehabbing?
Back on the scene. He drifts back into the scene because we wonder about him so much every week. And then Colt McCoy gets sat down after he played very well against Dallas.
He did.
They still kept a tight leash on him, which is good coaching. That's to be expected. And he did everything right. That's what a backup quarterback's supposed to look like.
Well, and I like
that's a great performance.
I like listening to Gruden on those Monday night games too, because he talked about a couple of those times when Colt McCoy kind of made some decisions on his own and kept the ball or took from a designed run, and it did. You just see that football smart in him.
He got more comfortable as the game progressed as well. Because he did leave some plays on the field in the first half, and in the second half he created some plays. But now you know that's enough for Colt McCoy. It's going to be about RG3 and a guy that his game is based on creating plays.
And speaking of Monday night, Indianapolis Colts on the road with the New York Giants. Here we go. I mean, this is going to be a really fun one.
I like this matchup a lot. The Giants, they're coming off a bye.
That's right.
Yeah, and someone, I saw an Eli Manning headline where it said, like, Eli Manning, there's time to salvage the season or something like that.
Salvage?
That's what I said. It's like, who's saying the season's over? I mean, aren't they 3-4?
Yeah.
That's
in a very competitive NFC.
Yeah, no. I mean, look, I get it. They're behind, and they got some catching up to do, but salvage the season. They've lost 4 games.
Yeah, we're at the midway point.
We're
not going to the junkyard just yet.
Yeah, too early to be talking about salvaging the season. But you play in New York.
And especially at week 9, if you're ready to just condemn a team already, and I hope you're not ready to condemn your preseason narrative of Andrew Luck ending the season as the league's best quarterback.
I did say that.
Oh, you did? That yeah. Might have landed on the cover of SI?
I feel good about it still. I feel good about it. I don't know. Look, will he be the best quarterback in the league by the end of the year? that we'll be splitting hairs on that one because Manning's having an unbelievable the article I wrote was more about luck than the other guys in the league. So Manning's having an unbelievable season. Aaron Rodgers is having his best year. Tom Brady's bounced back after, what, two bad games that was supposedly ended the world for him, and now all of a sudden, oh, we forget he's Tom Brady still. Roethlisberger's having a great year. I don't know who's going to be the best in the league, but luck's progression as a pro has stayed right on track this season. And there's not a guy I'd rather have under center, even right now. Give me one game to win and let the systems be neutral. Like, you know, if I get one game with the system, I want Peyton Manning running his system. But if I'm just, let's say I'm running a basic offensive scheme and I need a quarterback, I want Andrew Luck right now.
Now, do you think Greg Bedard might disagree with you a little bit? There were some shots fired in his column this week.
Yeah, there were shots fired, and I felt like I was being scolded. He didn't mention me, but he's mentioned people of my ilk.
Yeah, right when I read it, I thought Andy, and I texted you or something. I was like, whoa, Bedard, he's coming in hot.
But look, that was a good article that he wrote.
It was really well written, too. I was thinking, what is Andy going to think?
Yeah, I sat there reading it and thought, yeah, this is pretty good. We're going to have Bedard on the show next week.
Oh,
and
man, that'll be fun.
And we'll have the discussion for everyone to hear.
And I'll be the moderator between you two just trying to...
We'll be all right. Bedard and I mean, we'll be all right.
Cordial.
Yeah, we'll be cordial.
Ahmad Bradshaw and Hakeem Nicks both returning home.
Yeah, so I guess that means they have a chip on their shoulder, which we're supposed to get excited about.
Oh.
Bradshaw's having a very good year for them. Very good as a receiver in the red zone. The numbers back that up. The Colts do a good job with flat routes in the red zone as well, and misdirection off play action, all that kind of thing. Hakeem Nicks is the guy to me. I thought we'd see a little more out of him in India than we have so far.
Well, and they were both kind of considered damaged goods by New York, you know?
That's why they got here, yeah.
Right, but that's why it's sort of special, too, especially with Ahmad Bradshaw, who is, as you said, having a great season and has become that number one, well, is slowly becoming that workload or workhorse there in Indianapolis. But Hakeem Nicks, he was thought to have been let go or let move on because of the drops and because of a downgrade in his play. Do you see that this season, or is it just... nothing really jumping out?
It's more nothing jumping out. We haven't seen the mistakes that were prevalent in some of his games as at the end of his Giants career. I don't know if we've seen too many of the drops. I can maybe think of a few. But I like Nicks in that system because I thought he'd make plays late in the down for them. And Andrew Luck's very good late in the down. I thought there'd be some improv stuff there. And we haven't quite seen as much of that yet.
And his late in the down guy has been T.Y. Hilton this year. I think of plays where a quarterback holds the ball longer than 3 seconds, T.Y. Hilton has the most receiving.
And I think of it as just longer than the structure of the play, which is usually longer than 3 seconds.
Sure.
But just where things go out of structure. And the brilliance of Luck, and I'll make this point to Mr. Bedard next week, is that things don't go out of structure in Indianapolis very much. He has a way of extending plays without letting things break down. I thought on those play extensions, Nicks would be a little more of a guy for them. That hasn't happened yet, but that could be a chemistry thing too. That might take some time to build that rapport with the QB and receiver, and they've only been together for a few months.
All right, guys, that's all we have for you this week. Remember, you can follow me on Twitter at InglesAngle or Andy at Andy_Benoit. Remember to subscribe to the MMQB podcast on iTunes. We'll have Bedard next week, and we'll see how that showdown goes with Andy. From Andy, I'm John. We'll see you next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.